At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Now that he's got it, what's he going to do with it? The costs of Crimea for Mr. Putin on the broadcast today and some other stuff as well. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Monday today, the 17th of March. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. Clearly not a man to dilly-dally, Vladimir Putin wasted no time after the referendum in Crimea yesterday, late this evening, Moscow time. Mr. Putin signed a decree recognizing Crimea as, quote, sovereign and independent. Sanctions have, of course, been imposed by both the United States and the European Union, asset freezings and travel bans mostly. While getting Crimea might have been relatively cheap for the Russians, keeping it probably won't, as Marketplace's Noel King starts us off.
For people in Crimea who voted in favor of the breakaway, the post-referendum mood was euphoric.
We are come back to Russia. We happy. We all happy.
I love Russia. This is my dream, to live in the Russia. This is not Ukraine.
Annexing Crimea would be a political win for Russia, but economically, the peninsula is kind of a mess. William Pomerantz is with the Woodrow Wilson Center.
Russia is going to have to send billions of dollars to supply electricity, to provide water, simply to keep Crimea running.
Pomerantz says that could cost Russia $3 billion a year. And then there's the shadow hanging over tourism, a major part of the Crimean economy.
Most of these tourists come from Ukraine. So you're going to have to wonder what the summer season is going to look like in Crimea, because the usual Ukrainian tourists are not going to come.
It's also unclear what will happen to Ukrainian state property in Crimea and how to physically connect Crimea to Russia. Plans for a $1 billion-plus bridge are reportedly in the works, but construction could take years to finish. Then there are the international economic sanctions. For now, they're only hitting a few top Russian and Ukrainian officials. But Lilit Gvorgian, a senior economist with IHS Global Insight, says what counts is that the U.S. and Europe have warned those sanctions can be escalated.
These are serious negative messages that the investor community is receiving. We've already seen ruble weakening, that the equity markets punishing Russian companies.
All of which makes Crimea seem less like a prize for Russia and more like a drain on dwindling resources. I'm Noel King for Marketplace.
Much as Mr. Putin laughed, figuratively anyway, in the face of Western sanctions, so too did the markets, both here and in Russia. I won't spoil the surprise, but suffice it to say, it's going to be the happy music when we get there. All right, elsewhere in market capitalism today, the Chinese tech conglomerate Alibaba is getting ready to go public in what could well be the most anticipated IPO since Facebook and Twitter. We will, thankfully, be able to make a direct comparison of the three because over the weekend, the company made some news and said it's going to list itself in New York instead of in Hong Kong. Marketplace's Queenie Kim has more now on Alibaba and why it matters.
Alibaba is compared to Amazon because it dominates China's e-commerce market. But that's where the comparison ends. Perry Wong is a researcher at the Milken Institute. He says unlike Amazon, Alibaba doesn't sell goods directly.
It's a transaction platform rather than a merchandise selling outfit.
A middleman, in other words. He tells this story of using Alibaba.
I ordered something and then I got the delivery in 3.5 hours. The person who delivered this as a young man who rode on a bicycle.
Wong says people use Alibaba to buy everything from ramen for their dinner to big ticket items like computers. And the company does big business. In one day, Alibaba can sell more goods than all the e-commerce businesses in the U.S. put together. Duncan Clark is with investment advisory firm BDA China. He says Alibaba is into almost every consumer service in China.
They were at one point offering hospital appointment booking services. Another example would be a service called Didi Daksha, which is like Uber to book a taxi. And this is hugely popular now.
It's even into consumer banking. It recently started making microloans to small businesses and has a virtual wallet program that holds about $80 billion in funds. Paul Sweeney is an analyst with Bloomberg Industries.
When investors buy Alibaba, they're not just buying the growth of Chinese e-commerce, but they're also buying the growth of consumerism in China.
He says Alibaba does face stiff competition from other local firms in China, but big U.S. firms like Google and Facebook are nowhere. In San Francisco, I'm Quina Kim for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, well, I guess I did kind of spoil the surprise, didn't I? We'll have the details anyway when we do the numbers. You go to your computer or you pull out your phone, you fire up the browser of your choice, you type in marketplace.org, and magically, our website shows up. Except it's not magic. The internet is a deeply complicated and completely essential system, the architecture of which has been run under contract with the United States government by a group known as ICANN, the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers. Well, that relationship is going to change somewhat. The Commerce Department announced Friday it's going to get out of the internet business just as soon as a replacement group is set up to keep an eye on things. We've called up the CEO of ICANN, Fadi Shahadi is his name, to see how that might work in practice. Mr. Shahadi, good to have you with us.
Great to be here.
For those of us who don't necessarily follow top-level domain name protocols, what exactly is happening here?
Well, every time someone types the name of a website in the world, they type a name dot something. That something is called the top-level domain.
So .com or dot whatever.
Exactly. And we have expanded these now, so there will be hundreds of new ones in the months ahead, like dot green and dot Paris and dot Berlin, for example.
And how did it come to pass that you and the Department of Commerce, that is the American government, decided that the American government would not be involved anymore?
It's been envisaged from the foundation of ICANN 15 years ago that that would happen. The question wasn't if, it was simply when will the Department of Commerce cede its role of essentially giving confidence to the world that ICANN is doing what it's supposed to do to the community that includes the private sector, civil society, the users, governments, everyone. So the time has come.
Let me pick up on that word you used, confidence. Nobody will say that the United States is blameless in its internet handling, given recent world events. But who will take the Department of Commerce's place? What group? What organization? Will it be something like the United Nations that's going to do it?
No. There will be no new organization or an organization to replace the role of the United States. The United States was very clear that it intends for the multi-stakeholder community to devise mechanisms or processes that would replace its role through the organizations that exist today, rather than the creation of a new organization.
You'll forgive me, but that sounds like a veritable recipe for bureaucratic non-functioning.
Consensus building is not easy. If you've done it around your family table, you know how hard it is to get everyone to agree where to go for dinner. So, yes, this may not be the shortest route to make decisions, but it is the right route.
I appreciate your comments on the timing and how this has been in the works for a good long while. But one can't help but wonder if the United States is trying to show a little internet good faith to the global community after Mr. Snowden and his revelations.
Look, I think it is easy to attach a decision by the U.S. government to an event. If the coincidence is there, it is there. Has the Snowden affair raised in the global consciousness the need for internet governance? Maybe, and yes is the proper answer. But at the end of the day, this decision is independent of that. It is dependent purely on the work of thousands of people over 15 years that lead us to this day.
You understand how American businesses might be a little utsy about this.
In 15 years, we have not had a nanosecond of downtime. ICANN has managed the system with distinction. We will continue to do so. It is our number one priority.
Fadi Shahadi, he is the president and CEO of ICANN. Mr. Shahadi, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Kyle.
In Silicon Valley, about a year ago, somebody, the phrase sniper has been used, attacked a Pacific Gas and Electric substation in San Jose, California. The shooter took out 17 of the 23 transformers that are there and has yet to be caught. There were no power outages as a result, it must be said, but the whole thing did reveal a very uncomfortable truth about the vulnerability of the power grid in this country. A memo from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission this past June warned that if only 9 key substations were destroyed, along with one company that builds transformers, the entire American power grid would be down for at least 18 months, possibly longer. Marketplace's David Weinberg explains how that could be.
One way the terrorists could cause a nationwide 18-month blackout would be to take out multiple high-voltage transformers.
Basically, high-voltage transformers are big metal boxes that are filled with coils.
Granger Morgan heads the Department of Engineering and Public Policy at Carnegie Mellon. Transformers are crucial because electricity is generated at a fairly low voltage, but it's way more efficient to transport it at a higher voltage. To do this, you need a transformer.
That can move electricity from lower voltages to higher voltages to send it a long distance, and then at the other end, drop it back down to the lower voltages that goes out to end users.
When a large high-voltage transformer is damaged, it typically takes 1.5 to 2 years to build and deliver a replacement.
Until recently, we had stopped making most high-voltage transformers in this country. For the most part, they're made abroad.
Transformers can weigh hundreds of thousands of pounds, so shipping them overseas can take months. And they're super expensive, up to $8 million apiece, which is why we don't have a bunch of spares laying around. And although a nationwide outage from a terrorist attack is unlikely, major blackouts are increasing dramatically.
It happens during storms, during various other emergencies, and with the increased extreme weather that we have been experiencing.
Masoud Amin is a former director of security research at the Electric Power Research Institute. From the 1950s to the 1980s, major power outages averaged about 5 a year. From 2008 to 2012, those outages occurred between 70 and 130 per year. He says building a more resilient grid would cost $17 to $20 billion a year for 20 years.
That's very conservative.
The good news, says Amin, is that it would create more than 200,000 new jobs, and the savings from a more efficient power grid would far outweigh the cost. But until funding is made available, the only short-term solution is to increase security at substations and prepare for the inevitable blackouts. I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
If you, like millions of others today, have either just or are still working on filling out your March Madness NCAA basketball tournament brackets, hang on just a second. Forget the standard couple $100 office pool, all right? You might want to consider joining a competition with a significantly higher payout. The mortgage company Quicken Loans is offering 1 billion American simoleons to anybody who fills out a perfect bracket, gets all 67 games right. Warren Buffett's company is insuring the bet, by the way, so they're probably good for it, but all in all, how hard can that possibly be, number one? And what CEO in his right mind puts $1 billion on the line for a bunch of basketball games? Quicken's CEO Dan Gilbert owns the Cleveland Cavaliers, so there's that. But there's got to be more going on here than the love of the game, right? Marketplace's Dan Weissman has more.
Here's how hard it is to make a perfect bracket. Almost impossible. Jeffrey Bergen, a math professor at DePaul University, has done the odds. If you're just randomly filling out the bracket, they're worse than 1 in 9.2 quintillion.
9 followed by 18 zeros.
If you know something about basketball and you're actually picking games, the odds get about 10 million times better. But that still leaves you at 128 billion to 1. And maybe that happened once in the pre-digital age. However,
since these things have been electronic, there are no documented perfect brackets.
And first, people have to persevere through the sign-up process. Chris Hagen is the data reporter at WBEZ in Chicago. I asked him to do the sign-up on his iPhone with me. He coughed up his email address, his date of birth, his phone number, his street address.
Do I currently own a home? Do I plan to purchase a home?
The rate he pays on his mortgage. After 10 minutes, he had to enter his mobile number so they could authenticate his phone via
SMS.
Yep, there you go. I authorized Yahoo to send me automated marketing text messages. You just did that. Thank you. It's that last piece of information, Chris's cell number, that's valuable. Garth Graham worked for Stratmore, a company that consults to the mortgage industry. His specialty, customer acquisition. The contest will allow up to 15 million contestants. That's 15 million cell numbers.
Yes, I could probably figure out a bunch of people who I'd like to talk to about a mortgage, but I can only get phone numbers on about 15 to 20% of them.
The rest of us aren't listed, or we've joined the Do Not Call list, or both. In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
Coming up, why, oh why, in this day and age, do people still use business cards?
When you're looking at someone's business card, in a way, it's like you're looking someone in the eye.
Oh, all right. But first, let's do the numbers. All right, here you go. The Dow Industrial's up 181 points, 1.1%. Sanctions, what sanctions? Closed at 16,247, did the blue chips. The NASDAQ up 34 points, 0.8%, ended things at 4279. The S&P 500 advanced 17 points, almost 1%, closed at 1858. Yahoo was up 4%. Today, the internet company owns a big stake in the Chinese tech firm Alibaba, which we told you about up at the top of the broadcast. Other tech stocks caught the tailwind. Google clicked up 1.6%. Apple sweetened 0.4%. eBay up 1.4% today. Over in Moscow, the RTS index, the main index, up 4.9%. Bond prices here rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note down to 2.69%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on construction of new homes for February. It's National Biodiesel Day, observed on the birthday of engineer Rudolf Diesel. And do you want to live forever? Irene Cara sung all about it in the hit song Fame. It's her birthday tomorrow. She'll be 55. I'm Michelle Phillippe. Remember my name.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. One of the surest ways to create a thriving black market in something, commodities specifically, is to make it illegal. Drugs, of course. U.S. dollars in closed economies is another good example. Also, elephant ivory. The market there is, for want of a better word, booming, despite bans on international trade and crackdowns in many African countries. Damon Tabor wrote about the illegal ivory trade from source to final sale in the current issue of Men's Journal. Damon, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
This is an amazing story because it is an industrial story. It's a workforce story. It's a labor market story. It's a poaching story. It's an illegal story. I mean, there's everything in elephants, man.
It's true. I think what's really dramatically changed over the last several decades is the nature of poaching. The 1970s, 1980s, the last time we faced a great poaching crisis like this, you know, you had subsistence hunters who were killing maybe one, two, three elephants, something on a much lower scale. And now you've seen that really dramatically changed.
Maybe we ought to back up and get the lay of the market, if you will. There is amazing demand growing in China, and that fuels poaching in Africa, and it becomes then circular, right?
The demand is a function of sort of Chinese, you know, rising middle class. You have a sizable portion of China's population that now has disposable income and can afford to spend it on things like ivory trinkets and these intricately carved ivory statues.
Walk me through it, how this happens. Is it that poachers are just going out and killing it and supplying the market, or do they, I don't know, do they get a phone call from some guy running an ivory shop in Beijing that says, I need 40 tusks by Tuesday?
I think both. You see a range across the poaching trade. One gentleman that I interviewed for the story, Justin, you know, he had created basically a Walmart-style just-in-time inventory system, which is to say he would get an order from his buyers in China. And then he had a team of poachers working in the southeast of Cameroon, and he would transmit the order to them. They would go out, kill the elephants, and then Justin would pick them up, and then he would drive them from sort of the southeast remote part of Cameroon to the port, and then from the port, the ivory hit a customs official that was on his payroll, and from there it would be shipped to China.
You say, and I love this line actually, that the demand now and the poaching now has exceeded the reproductive capacity of the elephants, which means, of course, there will eventually be no more elephants left. What do these traders, what do the poachers, what do the folks in the stalls in Beijing say when you say, you know what, this is, it's going away?
You know, with the traders and the dealers and the middlemen that I spoke to in China and Vietnam, there's not a great deal of care for an animal that is several thousand miles away and they don't deal with directly. It doesn't affect their lives in an intimate, real way.
But the poachers then, huh?
Pierre, one of the poachers that I spoke with there in Cameroon, you know, he was an interesting case because I think he represents a lot of what you see in Africa and the battle that conservationists, environmentalists face, which is that Pierre was making essentially a rational economic decision. He was able to make several hundred dollars by poaching elephants and going into the jungle for 2 or 3 weeks. And with that money, he's able to feed his family. He's able to take care of his parents. He's able to send his children to school. And, you know, there were few other opportunities for him in the part of Cameroon where he lived. And I think it's a decision that very few of us wouldn't make in his shoes either.
Damon Tabor, his article is called The Ivory Highway, about the elephant and ivory poaching business. It's in Men's Journal. Damon, thanks very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
There's a small and shrinking list of things that are somehow able to survive in this increasingly digital economy. The feel and look of an actual handwritten letter instead of an email. The value of a face-to-face meeting instead of a video conference. The good old-fashioned business card instead of, well, what exactly, right? I mean, we've all got dozens of them gathering dust in our desk drawers, but survive, those business cards somehow do. From WLRN in Miami, Kenny Malone brings us this case study of how they do that.
There's a valuable lesson at the end of this business card story. Actually, why don't we start with that lesson?
If you're going to showcase something, showcase yourself and represent yourself in the right way.
We'll get back to this guy after we go to the bar.
Hi, guys. Welcome to Flanagan's.
Hey,
I'm Nelson. How you doing?
Today is a special day at Flanagan's Seafood Bar and Grill here in Coconut Grove. It's the monthly drawing for a free lunch, which falls to general manager Nelson Aaron Sebia.
You know, we just like shuffle them around a little bit and just pick one out, you know?
He sticks his hand into a wall-mounted wooden box filled with a few dozen business cards.
Okay, here we go. And the winner is Oscar R. Lopez from Allstate. You're in good hands with Allstate.
Oscar R. Lopez wins a $10 gift certificate. But if you play it right, business cards can be so much more than a glorified raffle ticket. I mean, in the grand scheme of things, you probably see more different kinds of business cards than the vast majority of people.
That's true, yeah. As a matter of fact, I have one in my car that I saved from this guy that's
Aaron Sebia can't remember the guy's name.
He's an artist, and
And this is an important point, because imagine if Aaron Sebia had just typed the artist's name and number into his phone.
You give someone your information digitally, and it's basically Rolodexed, never to be seen again.
Cynthia Henry Duval oversees business etiquette training for law students at Nova Southeastern University.
When you give someone a paper card, they have to pull it out of their pocket when they get home, so they look at it. They put it on their desk, and it probably sits on the desk for about a week or so, and then they pick it up because now they have to do something with it. And so that's 3 points of contact with your information.
Substitute desk for car.
Right, hold on, let me get my keys. Hold on.
And those points of contact are precisely what helped Nelson Aaron Sebia remember this artist guy. Aaron Sebia goes out to his car,
and
there's the card.
So his name is Ralph Cabrera. He's a professional illustrator, but I thought it was cool. You know, Superman here and things like that, all the artwork that he does.
So imagine that you're a designer and that you've now got your portfolio right in your pocket.
Stephanie Shores with a company called Moo, which didn't print the card we're talking about, but it did print a lot of other cards last year.
$108 million in 2013, yes.
And by the way, that's up by more than 400% compared to 5 years ago. Moo helped popularize those fancy little business cards with stylish designs on the back. If you're an artist, you can customize them. If you have no design sense, Moo takes care of it for you. Shore says in a digital world, people seem to be craving that personalization.
When you're looking at someone's business card, in a way, it's like you're looking someone in the eye. You want to understand what someone's doing. You want to have a real connection.
Which brings us back to the lesson of the story.
Just showcase yourself. You don't use somebody else. You don't endorse anybody else.
Illustrator Ralph Cabrera learned this the hard way. In case there's any confusion, this is the owner of the business card we've been chasing around.
He used to work for Marvel and DC Comics for 15 years.
But now Cabrera makes storyboards and mock-ups for advertising firms. And the card Cabrera handed to the Flanagan's general manager one day, it replaced a far less successful card Cabrera had designed. He pulls one of those old cards out of his bag.
It's got a black background. It's a bold statement. You know, I thought it worked well at the time.
At the time was any time before November 2009, because the centerpiece of this card is a beautiful drawing of golf legend Tiger Woods. And in November of 2009, a parade of alleged Tiger Woods mistresses started showing up.
Nobody really wanted to look at my card at that point. And my wife looked at it and says, man, we still have like another 3,500.
Cabrera had to scrap them all and make a brand new card, this time featuring a cartoon drawing of Cabrera drawing a cartoon drawing.
I figure I'd personalize it, let you know who I am even before you meet me.
Arguably, this paper business card worked like a charm. It caught Nelson Arancibia's eye at Flanagan's restaurant. Arancibia kept it and could show it to me in his car, and thus it let me contact Rolf Cabrera, who could teach us all.
Just showcase yourself.
And really, what that lesson boils down to is this. Even the comic book caricature version of yourself ultimately looks better on a business card than Tiger Woods. In Miami, I'm Kenny Malone for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, in which we close the loop on a story that was big, big news about 10, 11 days or so ago, the true identity of the person who invented Bitcoin. We told you about the media chasing a man named Satoshi Nakamoto through L.A. after Newsweek said he lived out in Temple City, California, was the guy who invented Bitcoin. They wound up somehow at the Associated Press Bureau in town, which, as it happens, is right next door to Marketplace Global Headquarters. Anyway, this morning, Mr. Nakamoto denied he's the guy, said he's hired a lawyer, and that he is not going to talk about it anymore. So you can add that to the list of mysteries in the news this week, I guess, huh? All right, we're done. That is Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow up 181 points, 1.1%. The NASDAQ rose 34 points. That is 0.8%. The S&P 500 advanced 17 points, almost 1%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner and Tommy Andres. Millie Jefferson directs the program. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdal. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.